Today is going to be our first remote podcast. Usually we do these in our literary salon in person. Our guest today is Tom Milani. We've had him here before in the restaurant, and so he's our debut author on our debut remote podcast as well. Tom Milani's short fiction has appeared online in Black Cat Weekly and Urban Pigs Press, as well as in several anthologies, most recently Janie's Got a Gun, crime fiction inspired by the songs of Aerosmith, Mickey Finn, 21st Century Noir, Volume 5, Into Deep, crime fiction inspired by the music of Aerosmith, and Sleuths Just Want to Have Fun, Private Eyes in the Materialistic 80s. Derringer finalist Barracuda Backfire was published in 2024 as book 4 of Michael Bracken's Chop Shop series of novellas. Tom's debut novel, Places That Are Gone, was just published by Unnerving. Tom is a member of Mystery Writers of America, Sisters in Crime, the Short Mystery Fiction Society, the Private Eye Writers of America, and the Authors Guild. Tom lives in Old Town Alexandria with his wife, glass sculptor Allison Segethi, and her work is really wonderful. So we're here today, Tom, to discuss your debut novel that came out, was it at the end of May or beginning of June?
May 13th.
May 13th. Well, congratulations. So you're well into your debut appearance here. Why don't we start off and tell viewers about a little synopsis, give us some back jacket copy, as always, without giving away the ending.
Okay, well, the novel is actually based on a personal experience of mine in the 80s. I lived in a condo in West Springfield, and, it was a big neighborhood, pretty quiet. And one day I was driving to work, and there was a woman hitchhiking, which was really unusual. It was the only time I ever saw a hitchhiker there. And so I picked her up and, basically dropped her off at the Beltway. But during the ride, she just started opening up to me in a way that was really unusual. She told me, a little bit about her life, about being a single parent, the things she'd had to do to make ends meet. And it really stuck with me. And right before I was going to drop her off, she said, I'd really like to party with you. And it's like, I was on my way to work, so that wasn't going to happen. I mean, I couldn't. But anyway, I let her off, gave her a little cash, and that was it. But that conversation really never left me. And I didn't think about it all the time, but it was always sort of in the back of my mind. So flash forward to the pandemic, and you and a couple of our other writer friends were all doing National Novel Writing Month. And so National Novel Writing Month, for people who don't know, the idea is to write 50,000 words in 30 days, which averages out to about between 16 and 1700 words a day. And the idea seemed kind of daunting, but you guys convinced me to do it. I'm so glad I did, because I had an idea, and the idea is, what would happen if a guy my age was driving to work, but we'll give him a bad marriage, and he picks up a hitchhiker who has secrets of her own that he doesn't know about, and when about the time he's ready to drop her off, she says, I wish we could party. And unlike me, my protagonist, Bennett Wilder, says, who says we can't? So that's the inciting incident in the book. And it turns out that Liz, the hitchhiker, has a few secrets of her own. She's in debt to a drug dealer, kind of rubs Bennett into helping her out. And things kind of go downhill from there.
You know, it's interesting that you have this sort of, I don't know if you call it a regret, but moment in the past, and you're like, what if I'd taken this other path, right? I wonder how often – I know for readers a lot of times fiction is sort of wish fulfillment, or it's experiencing something through somebody else's eyes without the risk that comes with the real world. How much was that the case with you, like going back and saying, okay, what if something had gone different?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for that, I never regretted the decision I made. But I always wondered, like, what would have happened if I'd said yes? What would happen if I'd, like, called in sick to work and we'd spent the day together? I mean, you don't know what would have happened. And it could have gone bad. It could have been sort of non-eventful. But, yeah, I think the road not taken, I mean, there's a couple of movies like that, Sliding Doors, Run, Lola, Run. They both deal with, if you did something a few seconds later, a few minutes later versus what you actually did. So I think a lot of people kind of wonder about, the phone call not answered, or the time that you know, you were too tired to go out. But, you know, if you'd gone out, maybe something wonderful would have happened. So, yeah, I think that's kind of what I wanted to do, is like bring the reader on that ride, you know. And it, for me, it was, you know, I didn't outline the book beforehand. So it was kind of I was going on that journey as I wrote it, too.
And when you go through it, how does it make you feel about, do you think about the real world and the real world consequences and what you did? Or are you so involved in this fictional story and weaving together plot threads that once you get past that inciting incident, you're just in another novel?
Well, I mean, I tend to inhabit my characters when I write. So I was in Bennett's head, because I did the first, during the month of November, I wrote basically 42,000 words, but it was all from Bennett's point of view. So I was like inhabiting that character, kind of imagining how he would react. I mean, this is from a, you know, perspective of being 40 years older, basically, or almost 40 years older. So I would try to think about how he would react to these various things happening. So yeah, I'm in the novel, but I'm also in the character's head.
So you mentioned National Novel Writing Month a couple times, and that's sort of a big deal for people. We're recording this in 2025, and National Novel Month earlier this year announced that they're no more, so that there won't be any more of those. How effective do you think that having that external sort of community pressure on reaching a specific word goal, whether you get there or not, right? The whole thing's about developing writing practice, but how effective is that as a writer? And for you, like you said, it was very daunting at the beginning. Yeah, and what do you think people will miss it? Do you think it's going to affect a lot of our writers?
I think, I don't know that I would do it every year, or that it even worked for another novel. But the experience itself was great, because, you know, for the first time, I think, like, I would write a chapter and type it up, but I wouldn't go back and edit it. And I normally, my writing's more recursive or iterative, where I'll go back and edit and then start the next. So this really forced me to just write and focus on plot. And I think because I had an inciting incident in my head, and I knew basically that bad things were going to happen, anytime, you know, I kind of slowed up or hit like a kind of a wall, I would just make more bad things happen. And I think in a lot of ways it was really healthy for my writing, because it made me focus on plot and in a way that I wouldn't necessarily do or hadn't necessarily done before. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, they ended it, and I think, you know, they would probably admit that they kind of made some mistakes. But, you know, they're a small, I guess, nonprofit, and as we know, the internet doesn't always bring out the best in people, so they probably had to deal with things they never thought, because I think they meant it in an altruistic way. You know, this is a chance for people to get together and write. They didn't imagine, you know, trolls or, you know, people harassing other people. So, but I think, yeah, I think it will be missed. The nice thing about National Novel Writing Month is, you know, anyone could start something similar, like with their own circle of writing friends, and they could have that same sense of accountability and this kind of thing where we're all in this together. And I think that camaraderie, you know, I'm not so big on camaraderie with strangers, but, you know, with people you know, people you respect, I think it does bring out the best, you know, the best in your writing.
So you say that this word count that you're shooting for kind of kept you driving in the narrative. Do you know, what do you think's happening, like, in a writer's mind when they reach that flow state, or when you're you know you have to write every day, you know you have to get words down? Is it silencing, like, the other things that are fighting for attention in your consciousness, or is it just this idea that if you can, by writing as fast and as much as you can, or the total focus, you're just putting yourselves deeper into the character?
I think there's some of that. I also think, like, the things that we would normally, you know, might say to stop us from writing, you know, I have this to do, I have that to do, or I'm not feeling it. I mean, if you're committed to doing the month, that sense of obligation, I think, drives you forward. And I think a lot of times, you know, just the push gets you over that little hump where you're struggling a little bit, and then you get into the writing. So I think that's what it does. I mean, It puts you in the writing life in a way that if you have a day job and other things that you know, sometimes, maybe for good reasons, maybe for not, you know, let other obligations get in the way. But as long as you have this commitment to write, 1,600 words, I think it did force you to really think deeply about your work and to get the plot moving, just to get in the story as quickly as you could and not worry so much about whether the words were perfect or, whether everything made sense, but just to get something down. I mean, I think it's helpful that way.
And has that NaNoWriMo experience affected your daily writing habit today? Like, does that still kind of linger in the back of your mind if you feel yourself being pulled in other directions?
I think so. I think the sense of obligation is there. I mean, I do feel like I try to write 6 days a week, and I try to do at least something. Most days I try to, have a significant chunk of time, 3 or 4 hours where I'm thinking about it or actually doing the writing. But I think the biggest thing I got out of it was just kind of wanting to be accountable to myself. And, when you hit a certain age or when you start writing, you kind of realize that, your existence is finite. And, I think a lot of us have things we want to say and things we want to say in multiple books. And knowing that, you don't know how much time you're going to have, I think it gives you focus. And that's, I think, like NaNoWriMo kind of reinforced that idea or was the backdrop to that idea as I got a few years older.
So in this book, beyond the path not previously taken, what was it you wanted to say? And like what is the theme in this book?
I think, originally I just had it. I knew it was going to be a noir story. But as I wrote it and thought about it, really a lot of it is about it's a cautionary tale because Bennett, my protagonist, he's kind of gone through life passively. I mean, he has a job that he doesn't really like, but looking for a new job's kind of hard. He's in a marriage that he probably shouldn't have gotten married in the first place, but because they were engaged and he didn't want to deal with the social fallout of breaking of engagement, he gets married. When their marriage starts to take some bad turns, he doesn't leave because he's embarrassed or whatever. So he has this real innate failure to act. And I think I wanted to explain, like, he's not self-actualized. I think it would be the psychological term. So when Liz comes along and he acts, I mean, on the one hand, he is acting, but it's not really acting in the sense of this is something he wants to do. It's just jumping at another opportunity rather than, I mean, what Bennett should do is talk to his wife and realize it's not working out. He should start looking for a new job, that his skills are drawn to. Like, he should be a teacher, because he loves writing. He loves poetry. He's really good at talking to people about it and explaining it. Has a real passion for it. But, he sort of took the easy way out. So I guess that would be my message is, you have to act in a way that's sort of true to yourself and not just always be reacting.
Oh, there's so much good stuff in there. Let's unpack it just a little bit. Like, how important is it for a character to show agency? And then does it matter if the action that they're taking is right or wrong or even in their own best interest? Is it just important that they're doing something for – I'm talking about from like the reader's perspective and your general story.
Yeah, absolutely. Agency is important. Otherwise, if you see a character just pulled along from one scene to another and not acting, then he's almost like a – I mean, he's sort of like a puppet. He's not really someone that you can relate to. I mean, when the thing to Bennett's credit is like maybe he makes some bad decisions that gets him into this situation. But once he's in it, a drug dealer pulls a gun on him and he's unarmed and Liz, the hitchhiker is unarmed and he gets him out of that situation. I won't tell you how, but that's a case where, his being able to react without thinking about it is helpful. And I feel like that pulls the reader along because, you know, you're in his shoes and you're thinking, what would I do if I was in his place? And so in contrast to Bennett is Liz, who she actually is self-actualized because she's in a bad situation. It's of her own making, but she doesn't lie to herself about what happened. And she takes steps to get her out of it. Now, they're not always, you know, maybe the most beneficial to the people around her or whatever, but she is actually trying to change her life. And, you know, so I think there's a contrast between the two of them.
You know, you're a really thoughtful author and you get deep into the character motivations. And I'm curious, like when you're creating these characters to begin with, how much of you is in these characters? And is there a point when they start acting sort of independently from you and doing things that surprise you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I share some things with Bennett. Like I didn't wrestle. I've never killed anybody, but, I think when I was younger, I used to be like less, I kind of let things happen to me, just sort of fell into situations, wasn't always as active as I should be. But what I try to do when I write is really inhabit the character. So, I mean, I talk about empathy a lot, and even the bad people, you know, bad guys. I mean, that's why in like movies and sub villains or in writing, villains are compelling characters. I think it's because the author inhabits that character. And you try to find an internal logic that even if these are things you wouldn't do personally, you can understand it from, you know, from that character's point of view. So when I write, you know, with Bennett and with Liz and with Paul, I mean, I really tried to put myself in those people's heads. And, like, I didn't feel like I was manipulating them. I feel like they were acting just kind of in ways that came natural to them. So it's organic in a way. I mean, I don't, you know, sometimes the characters will take on a role that you didn't necessarily intend. They'll become bigger, like a bigger part of the story. And it's hard to say why that happens, but I think when it does happen, you should go with that feeling because the writing's telling you something. I mean, if the prose is coming out good and the character is compelling, why would you stifle that?
Yeah, I've interviewed over 125 authors since we've been here, and I've heard similar things from a lot of authors. And what I found interesting is a lot of people who are avid readers but don't write have trouble understanding that. Like they often think that what the characters are doing is what the author believes, or what the author's done, or what the author would do. And a lot of times readers don't understand how an author can put themselves into a completely different character, but then act with authenticity within that character's motivations. Like, how difficult was that for you? Is that something you developed over time where you could really inhabit this character, or was it something that always came naturally to you?
I think it came naturally. I think I got, you know, better the longer I wrote, but, I think it did come naturally. I think, my parents, my dad especially, I think kind of raised us to be like tolerant and empathetic to people and to understand that, you know, you don't always know why people are in the circumstances they're in. And so I think I kind of brought that to my writing. I mean, you know, that they're but for the grace of God go I. I mean, that's true in a lot of ways. I mean, you think of, I mean, you've been in more harrowing situations than I am, but think of even when you're growing up, you know, if things had gone differently, if you'd been born in a different neighborhood, a different zip code, I mean, your life could be radically different. And so I think, you know, I try to bring that, and I like inhabiting other characters. I mean, it's nice to go back to reality, right? You know, you have your nice domestic life and things are pretty calm. Like, I don't like drama in my life, but I love it in my fiction, you know, so.
You mentioned when you were younger, you sort of let life happen to you as the author, as a person.
Yeah,
did you find that in writing characters with more agency, did that affect your personal life? Did it affect the way you interacted when you're away from the page?
I think, I think people used to tell me that my characters were passive. And I think as I've gotten older, just maturing, and, you know, when you hit a certain point of, in life where you realize that a lot of things that made you self-conscious or mad or don't anymore. I mean, that's one of the kind of virtues of growing old. And I think, yeah, I think my friends telling me that my characters were too passive kind of made me, definitely in my fiction, you know, make them more active. And yeah, I think it's just, you know, I was sort of a late bloomer. It kind of took me a while to come into my own. And, you know, I'm still not all the way there, but I'm a lot better than I was 40 years ago.
And it's so interesting, right? And I appreciate your honesty with these questions. It's hard to be introspective with this stuff, too, but you're obviously very thoughtful about it. Let's get a little meta on that question, though. It's interesting, right? Because a lot of writers will write something to work out a psychological issue on the page or to try to figure out some philosophical conundrum that they've been struggling over. And then as you write, and as you did a great job of describing, you're through your characters, you're learning to approach things in a different way. So if you are writing on the page to figure things out, and then your characters are helping you even change and modify yourself, how does that go back to the page and change you as a writer? Like in what the writer you were, say, 10 years ago, how different is that writer in interacting with characters and plot problems than the writer today?
Yeah, the writer today, like, I'm a lot clearer on seeing plot problems before they, you know, kind of fester. I'm sort of aware of that. I'm like more aware of the need for twist and the way to, and especially to keep the action going. A friend of mine, I'd written a novel that wasn't really going anywhere, and she wrote me an 8-page letter. But the key takeaway from that is every scene should matter. It should advance the plot or advance character or both. So I think I'm just way more aware of that now. I'm also more conscious of having my characters act, even passive characters. If they start out that way, at some point, you know, they change and they do more action. Or if they don't act, other characters do. I have an unpublished novel that I'm pitching with a brother and sister. And, you know, the brother's big mistake in his life was not, you know, marrying his girlfriend because he just wasn't ready for commitment. But his sister, like, is totally self-actualized, and she's taking steps to improve her life. So there was that contrast. So I think that came out here where Bennett was passive, becomes more active, but Liz was always active. So I think, you know, they're sort of foils to each other in a way.
But how many?
I'm much more aware.
Oh, no, that's really interesting. Sorry to interrupt you there. How many unpublished novels do you have, or how many have you written in total?
I've written 8. I have 5 first-person PI novels, 3 of which I had an agent for that she wasn't able to sell. And then I have 3 standalones. So the one that we're talking about now, Places That Are Gone, and I have a novel called Power Lines, which takes place in Northern Virginia, like kind of from the 70s to the present day. It's a sort of a family saga. And I have a novel called Potomac Sound, which is about it's about the 2008 housing crisis and that, the effect of that on 2 different families. I've written a lot of novels. But the 3 standalones, I think are the most, are the best work I've done.
So I know a lot of readers don't really know the business of writing and like what it takes to write a book and how long it takes, but a lot of writers don't either. And the business has changed so much, even over the last 5 years. It's really interesting. Like you say, you have an agent and had represented these books but couldn't sell it. That's actually more common than not. You know, just getting an agent, something like 1 out of every 4,000 queries get accepted. And then when they get accepted, the chance of getting into like a big 5 publishing house is really small. So I want to talk to you a little bit about this debut experience. You've written all these books. This is the first one you've been able to hold in your hand. That's the beautiful cover. And tell me what, let's go back. What did it feel like? How much did you query it? Let's start there. How much did you query this to try to get it published?
I queried to a lot of independent publishers, especially people who I thought would take noir. And, you know, I think I came close a little bit with Hard Case Crime. I mean, the guy said he actually asked for the full and read it, but said it wasn't, he didn't love it. And, I queried a few agents. What kind of threw me off the agent path was, I wrote this book, I think, in 22, and we're still on the edge of the pandemic, and one of the agents I queried, who I respect, said, look, I like your writing, but but this is too dark, and I'm hearing that from a lot of editors and publishing houses. Well, I mean, it is a dark book, but I think dark's back in fashion now. But I guess, you know, in 2022 it wasn't. And for better or worse, that sort of put me off querying agents. I mean, I did some, but then I did query a lot of independent publishers. And Unnerving is a Canadian publisher that I actually had sold a short story to. They just started a crime imprint, and they were looking for crime fiction. So I pitched something to them, and they took it. So when I pitched pitched the novel, I was able to mention that. And he said it would take 6 months to get back to me. He got back to me 5 months to the day. So that was a great day. Although I think it was pretty anticlimactic in a way, because I just finished a group bike ride. I was coming out of the bike shop, about to walk my bike back to the garage. I opened my phone, and it's like, oh, I get a message from Eddie, the publisher. He said, yeah, I'm going to take this. And it's like, I look around me, it's like there's no one I know there who knows I write. So, and I wanted to tell people, but so anyway, I just forwarded it to my wife, and she was mad at me. It's like, how could you not tell me, not call me, you know, so. But then after that, I started telling people, and, you know, that was fun because a lot of people know I write, know I've been writing for a long time, and, you know, they were happy for me to finally have a novel coming out. And the whole thing with Unnerving was good because, you know, he does his own covers, and he asked me for ideas, and we had a painting of a car at night, real moody painting that I liked, so I sent him a picture of that. And he came back with the cover, which is this, you know, here. You know, kind of blood red with the headlights gloomy. And it's like it perfectly fits the theme of the book. So, and he did a really nice job with the layout. A lot of people don't know this, but, you know, just because you turn in your book in, they don't take it as is. They do editing. And I thought his editing was really thoughtful. He mentioned where there's some repetition, and he thought something should be, you know, moved from one scene to another. So ended up cutting about 3,000 words, and I felt like it was, you know, a tighter, better book.
There's so much there I want to ask you about. Let me do them in reverse order here.
Okay.
So you had this cover that absolutely looks like it was made for the book. Because you saw this picture before, do you think somehow the picture influenced your subconscious in the creation of this novel?
Totally. I mean, when my wife got me that picture for Christmas one year, that painting, and I loved it. I said, this would make a great book cover. I wish I had a book, you know, that could take this cover. And, so I think probably in the back of my mind, I wanted to do, because it's a noir cover, you know, and I wanted to do something noir. And, you know, when the NaNoWriMo thing came along, it's like, okay, I got my idea. I had my subject, and I knew it was going to be dark, so.
And so you mentioned like dark and the zeitgeist coming out of the pandemic. I know horror is on the rise now, and you know times are dark for a lot of people in certain ways. This book, how long did it take you to write the book? Let me ask.
About 10 months.
All right, 10 months. You wrote it in 2022. You're coming out in 2025, right? So it's like 3 years later from when you started this book. That's a long time. Is there any way for authors to be able to try to anticipate market or anticipate zeitgeist or have any idea what someone's going to want by the time this thing gets traditionally published?
Absolutely not. I think you have to write the book you want to write. If you start tracing, you know, chasing trends, right? You know, if you're doing a big five, you're probably a year and a half, maybe 2 years. But, you know, query and get an agent, then another 18 months to get published. I mean, like Romanacy is really big right now. Would that be big in 18 months? I don't know. I mean, there were some dark books published during the pandemic. But you're right. Now there's like Sean Cosby's new book is out. And that's really dark. The Alana Berry's Peacock and the Sparrow, that's a dark book. I mean, there's a lot of darker stuff out there. So I think you have to write the best book you can. I think you have to be aware of trends to the extent that, like, if you want to write an 800-page thriller, it's probably not going to get published because thrillers, you know, they're typically 90,000 words. They're not 190,000 words. So, I mean, you have to be realistic about the industry, but within those confines, you know, write the book you want to write.
you also mentioned that you're standing out there with your bike and you get this email after all these years and you've got a book and a publisher. I mean, it's a really big deal. Like, the chance of getting published by any publisher is really small. You know, in the, I mean, there's something like 3 million books that come out a year, but the over 2 million of them, or 2.5 million of them, are self-published, right? So it's a very small number of actually traditionally published books. So you get this moment and your first thought is, you're looking around, you don't really, or you're not, no one knows you're a writer. What is it in that human condition that makes us want to immediately share? Like, why is sharing news like that so much more meaningful when someone else is involved?
Well, I think, I had to really kind of talk myself into this a little bit, because I'm not really, like, if you ever look at my Facebook feed, there's not a lot of sharing. I mean, I'll share other people's news because I'm happy for them, but it's, I mean, I have friends, and I'm good in small groups. I'm not really good in big groups with anonymous people. And at times I can be introverted, but, you know, writing the book, telling people about that, it's one thing, but you're also putting yourself out there. You're putting yourself out there to strangers. So I kind of had to realize, like, you know, a lot of people want you to succeed. And my wife's been really big in telling me that, like, people want you to to succeed. You know, they're happy for you, so celebrate. And it's like, okay. I mean, because I think about, you know, the friends I know who publish books and how happy I am for them, for the same reason you said. It's a really, first of all, I know how hard they work. It's really hard to get published. And, yeah, it's reason for celebration, because you don't know how many of these, how long you'll be doing it, not, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it has been fun. And, you know, people, like, will ask me questions about the book or talk to me about it. And it's, or, you know, you get people's reaction. You know, they said it was real page turner. They couldn't put it down. I mean, if you're a writer, there's nothing better than that, you know, having someone tell you they couldn't put your book down.
So that's a great compliment. So you talk about being a little bit of an introvert. I go to conferences. I talk to writers all over the country all the time. Most of us have some level of introversion, right? Because the life of a writer is this internality. It's this, you know, it's this living world within your mind. I want you to think back. I know you've published a lot of short fiction, really great short fiction as well. Can you think back to the first one when you were actually published? So your short story, this thing that had lived only in your mind, and now you're seeing it on the internet or in a magazine, wherever it was. What was, not just how did that feel, but, like, how scary is that? Like, when all of a sudden you realize, you know, thousands or tens or hundreds of thousands of people could be reading this thing that had previously existed only in your mind.
You know, the first story I sold was to Michael Bracken for Groovy Gumshoes, Private Eyes in the Psychedelic 60s. And Stacy Woodson, our friend, had organized like a Zoom call with Michael where he told people how to pitch to an editor. So I saved the slides from that. I actually used his wording verbatim. And I think he was looking for ideas. Anyway, I pitched my story. What I did was I knew the story I was going to write because there's a Twitter thing. I'm sorry I'm digressing, but there was a Twitter poll, like, if you could go back in time, you know, for a historic event, what would you do? And it's like, I knew the answer right away because I like to see the Beatles in Hamburg before they were the Beatles, when they were coming up. When, if you ask, you know, John Lennon at one time or another said that's when they were doing their best music. So when this Groovy Gumshoes idea came out, like, I knew I wanted to set it in 1960 in Hamburg. And, you know, my goal was to have him take the story and have it be the first one published in the collection, because I was hoping he'd go chronologically, you know, and both things happened. So for me, it was like, I did a ton of research for that story. So it was like really validating in a way that said, okay, someone else out there who's really respected has written thousands of stories himself, likes your work and is willing to publish it. So I guess that wasn't as daunting, having the novel out there and knowing people were going to read that, and knowing how dark the novel was and how personal it was to me, that was more daunting.
So you call yourself, you know, introverted, yet you've read at several noir at the bars. You've done some here at Elaine's Literary Salon, and you don't come across as introverted. Are there tricks, since most writers are, right? Since, I mean, let's face it, most of us have this in us. What are there certain tools or tricks you've done that have helped you to perform in public and to expose yourself like this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I practiced the first noirs. I mean, I would read to my wife, and I'd read it, you know, multiple times. So yeah, we worked really hard at it. I would record myself reading and then play it back. And that's kind of eye opening. If you never recorded your voice and heard it back, like the things you don't think about when you're reading aloud, the stumbles, the mispronunciations, I mean, nothing will come through more clearly than that. So, rehearsals is huge. I mean, it's made me more confident as a reader. I'm also, because I've done so many noir at the bars, I kind of know, like, the kind of story that works, that sounds good. And a lot of times, less is more. You don't need real long, complicated sentences. And if you can have a, you know, if it's a funny story, you want to allow pauses for people to laugh or whatever. And you want to be more animated in your speech. But yeah, a lot of that, I mean, you get more comfortable the more you do something. And so that's what it is. I mean, I've done a lot of practice, a lot of rehearsal. Anytime I do an OR at the bar, I read aloud to myself, and I'll read aloud to Allison, my wife, and then get feedback from her. And, yeah, so, and then I haven't been to many conferences, but I've been to ShortCon at your restaurant, which is fantastic. And the nice thing about that is it's 40, you know, basically 40 people and some instructors. So it's more intimate, so it's easier to get to know people, easy to talk to people. And, you know, you stay for the dinner after and have a beer, then it loosens everybody up, and, you know, then people become even easier to talk to, so.
Yeah. You're absolutely right too about a spoken version of the story having to be different, and it's not just the applause breaks, right, but it's the actual cadence and the way it's heard. When a lot of writers will read dialogue out loud when they're writing their manuscript because they, so they can hear it, make sure it's working. But does the reader's brain process this differently when they're reading it off the page? Like, why is it, or how could this be a pitfall for writers when they're typing a manuscript versus like reading it out loud? Because people do hear it differently. You know, is reading out loud a good thing on your manuscript?
I've never really done it for my writing. Because I feel like I have a pretty good ear, you know. I've always felt like, especially for dialogue, I mean, I feel like I have a good ear for that and a good ear for pacing. But when you're reading it aloud, a story aloud, I mean, it's a performance, right? An OR at the bar is a performance. It's not like you're giving a reading, you know, at a book signing where you're just reading the first chapter of your book or the prologue. I mean, when you're doing an OR at the bar, ideally it's a story that you've written just for that event. And it's a performance. So performance to me is different. And so I would say it affects the writing a little bit more than it would if it was, you know, the original medium was going to be on the page. I mean, the noir at the bar story, if it gets published, that's sort of that's a bonus. But most of the ones I've written, I mean, I've written them to be read aloud. And then when I think about publishing them, you know, maybe I'll edit them or change some things after the fact. But I do write them for performance.
There was something else you said that I found interestingly, that Lennon had said the early work of the Beatles was their best stuff. Do you think that's, I don't know if he expounded on that, but is that because like they had things in them, emotion or feelings they wanted to get out, and then once they did, it was done? Or is it because they were chasing markets, so doing things maybe for a broader audience that was less artistic? Or because as people like writers, like paralleling it to your work, for example, right? The more you write, the better you get. So it seems strange that your best stuff would be your first stuff.
Well, I have a couple ideas about it. First of all, John Lennon, I think he liked to say sort of controversial things. But I think what he missed, or what was exciting about those early days, is they were learning together, right? So it was a band. He and Paul and George basically were before Ringo came. You know, they were learning their craft. They were also learning what worked in front of a demanding audience, right? They're playing in Hamburg bars where they're violent places. There are lots of drunk places. And they had to play for 6 or 7 hours a night. So like the energy there for their shows is probably off the charts. I mean, it was almost like the early days of punk. I mean, they were doing things like that. I think what he objected to later on was when they play live, girls are screaming, so they couldn't hear themselves play. So he felt like their craft kind of faded. But if you look at their music and listen to, like, the difference between, say, Abbey Road and Please Please Me, I mean, it's amazing. It's like 6 years difference, but it's light years improved. I mean, they were doing things. I mean, Abbey Road still stands up. I mean, I love Please Please Me, but, you know, it's obviously of a place in time, but Abbey Road is almost timeless. So I think in some ways, you know, he was, maybe they had the best emotions in 1960, 1961, but, you know, later on, they had to improve their craft. As far as writers go, I mean, some writers, you know, like Norman Mailer's first book was Naked and the Dead. I don't know if that's his best, but it's probably pretty high up there. I think a lot of times, you know, some writers, they have their best, you know, maybe their best novel is their first, but I think a lot of them, that's not the case. I mean, they get better. And I certainly have. I mean, I look at my first PI novel, which never sold, and like that's a book there's so many problems in that. I mean, if I rewrote it, I'm not even sure how much of the plot would still be there. You know, it's like, so yeah, I mean, I think a lot of writers do improve.
Screaming fans distracting you seems like a good problem to have. What would it be like reading your manuscripts? I mean, you do the noir at the bars, but, you know, doing your work in front of live crowds and getting that instant feedback. How is that as a writer?
Well, it's great. I mean, I think a lot of writers wish they could be rock and roll guitarists, you know, because, I mean, it's like you're doing Like musicians, especially, they move people, right? I mean, music is a very emotional thing. You get an emotional reaction in people. And as a writer, you're hoping for that, but you don't, I mean, because, you know, you're writing books and you don't, unless people tell you, you don't really know what kind of reaction you're provoking in them. In a concert venue, I mean, you can actually see it, right? I mean, people get up and dance, or people are yelling, or if, you know, there's dead silence, you know, in a classical concert, then the applause is thunderous afterward. I mean, I think that feedback would be fantastic, but you're not too likely to get that as a writer unless, you know, you're nominated for some big award or something.
So you make a really good point. If you're not under contract with a publisher, you're writing on spec, which 99% of writers are doing all the time. How do you keep going? How do you motivate yourself to get through like a 11-month project? You know, something where it takes, I mean, so much work. It's so difficult. You're doing, a lot of times people are doing it while they're working. How do you stay motivated when you don't know, like, for if you'll even get it published, or if you do get it published, what the audience reaction will be?
Well, to me, there's two things to motivate me. One, like, if I like what I'm writing, if I'm enjoying the story, I want to tell it. You know, I mean, I think a lot of writers, and, you know, you've always talked about how you have these stories you want to tell. And I think that's within us. Like, we have these stories we want to tell that we feel like they matter. We feel like they're important. But there's also, I mean, for me, like, if I stop writing, that would be like killing off a part of myself. I mean, it would feel like giving up in a way that, you know, I mean, I haven't always written every day. I've gone months sometimes between things years ago, but I never gave up on the idea of writing. I never gave up on there were times I thought it wouldn't happen, that I wouldn't get published, but I never actually considered just stopping. And I think that would be like, it would be like, I would feel like there was this part of me that was missing, you know? And so, I mean, that's how it is for me. Like, I know there's people who write, they write for a number of years, they have some success, and then they turn to a different art or whatever. I mean, I don't really have that in me. Like, I don't have the painter genes or the music genes or whatever. And I like what I like, and I like writing, and I just can't imagine stopping, you know?
So do you think that storytellers are born, or is this something are you created? Because obviously you get better technically as a writer the more you write, right? They say a million words to really achieve some level of mastery. But are you born with that? Is that something genetic, or is that something just that, from your early childhood that affects you, or is it a combination of both?
I think some people probably are born storytellers, like they're born creatives. But I think for a lot of us, like we're readers, and we fall in love with reading. And, you know, I fell in love with reading at an early age. It's still like one of my favorite things to do. And if you fall in love with reading and you read a lot, you get a sense of, you start to develop your own taste, and you find out like what kind of writing you like, what kind of writing you don't like, what appeals to you. And then, you know, maybe you take a class in school and you decide, and you know, writing class, and you get some feedback and you decide this is something you'd like to do. Or, you know, basically, if you take any kind of liberal arts degree, you're going to be writing because you have to write papers. And so I think you develop a love of writing, and then you find you have something to say. And, you know, what those things are obviously depends on the individual, but, you know, I think your background plays a lot in it. Plays a big part in it. You know, I read this great quote online. I can't remember who it was, but someone said, like, you can't transcend your childhood, but you can transform it. And I really latched on to that because, you know, as my wife and I joke with each other, you know, like bad things that happen, it's all material. So, you know, someone cuts you off in traffic, it's material. You know, you have a bad marriage, you get out of it, that's material. I mean, everything's material. And I think when you can find a way to use those things, it's actually healthy and productive. And it's also common. I mean, people have all these common experiences, but they don't always know how to articulate them. Sometimes reading how someone else articulates something, you know, it opens your own eyes.
So. I love that. So I've got to talk to you a little bit about your process, because it's really unique. And every author I talk to has a slightly different process, but there's a lot of commonality. Yours is fairly unique. Let's start off with what do you use to write?
So I use pencil, mechanicals, 7mm lead. I write longhand, usually on a tablet. And I used to write a whole chapter and then type it up, but now I write until I get stuck. If I get stuck, then I type up those pages. I edit them online. I print them out. I edit them again, and then I continue writing. And that's how I do it. And even when I get a draft done, I'll print it out, because I always edit online. But when I print something out, you see things that you don't see online. And then I'll mark stuff up, move paragraphs around, and all that. Make those changes online. Read it again, print it out. So it's a really iterative process.
Do you have any idea why that is, that readers, like, you look at something, I mean, you're writing on pads, you say, what, legal pads, so is it white paper, yellow paper?
And
the lead, so it's a black, like a black writing on it. But you're looking at a computer, it's a white background with black. Like, it seems like it should be pretty much the same, but it clearly isn't, right? We all see that. You look at something 100 times on the computer, then you print it out, and mistakes just jump out at you. Do you have any idea what causes that?
I think it's the reason, like, you don't see double words. You know, you read over it, you know what you wrote, you read over it. But I think, and especially if you've typed it on the laptop, right, then you're reading it again. Well, you're reading what you just typed. So I think it's easy to miss stuff. When you print it out, you're reading it, but you're reading it a different way. There's not the distraction of the screen. And you can, like, spread out two pages or three pages, or you can flip back to where you wrote something to see if you – so it's just a different way of looking. I think both are useful because as any writer knows, search and replace is your friend, especially I inadvertently changed the character's name halfway through, and then you have to go back and find it, you know.
So, search and replace is great until you realize you're searching and replacing a word that's also a part of other words.
Yes, I know. Why is that capitalized in the middle of my word? Yes,
and you were an editor before you started writing, right?
I was an editor for almost about 27 years. I worked over 26 years for a federally funded research and development center. And so I edited like very technical reports, like on demining and, you know, test reports. I also edited, we had a project called Africa Watch, was current events in Africa that I worked on. One of the projects I did was this Iraqi reconstruction, Afghanistan war reconstruction. It was a whole history. And that's where all that fiction writing training paid off, because you get work that was probably originally in Farsi. It's translated by somebody. So you have, you know, these pages of dialogue. But some of the sentences tended to be run on, you know. So basically, when I would edit that, like, I wouldn't change the words, but I'd, you know, add periods where I felt like the sentence broke, and, you know, try to make it, you know, the dialogue make sense. So, but editing teaches you, makes you a lot better at your own grammar and spelling and then word usage. So, you know, people will tell you, like, if you want to learn something, teach it, because it makes you really dig deep. If you want to learn, if you want to improve your own writing, you know, edit other people's. It really made me aware of things.
You mentioned 3 to 4 hours of good time every day. Do you write at a specific time? Do you write in a specific place? Like, what are your rituals and how important are they?
Well, my first ritual is to make coffee in the morning. I mean, there's nothing happens without that. If I don't have it, I go out and buy it. But I have a nice office. I work in my office, and generally I'm on call with you and Adam Meyer and Stacey Woodson. I try to do that like 3 or 4 days a week. And so we'll talk for a little bit, and we'll write for about an hour, and then come back on and talk some more. And that process has been good, especially if I'm trying to work out a problem. I'll try to tackle that in that hour. And then I'll maybe write a little bit after that, then probably eat some lunch. If I go out for a bike ride or something, then when I get back from that, I'll do some writing. A lot of times at night, I didn't used to write as much at night, but I found that it still works for me. I'll do some editing, or I'll try to fix a scene at night. So I don't sit in like a 4-hour block and work unless I'm like doing final read through of a book. But when I'm working on a story, I kind of split it up during the day. But I do try to put in time, you know, try to put in a decent amount of time.
Do you have to be at your desk, or can you write anywhere?
Well, since I'm retired, I'm usually at my desk, but and I've had to take the car to the dealer, I'll bring a notebook with me and write. And that's actually worked out better than I thought it would, because, you know, they had a decent waiting room, a lot of white noise. Sometimes if I'm on vacation, I'll bring a notebook and write something, but most of the time I write here, just because it's a comfortable space for me.
Sure. So you've mentioned like a third of your anthologies are basically about music, and you mentioned the Beatles. So can you listen to music while you write, or do you need some kind of silence? You mentioned the white noise at a dealership.
Yeah, no, I can't write with music. I can't even write with instrumental music. I don't, you know, if my wife's here and she's going back and forth, that usually doesn't bother me. And if there's noise next door, that doesn't bother me, but I can't write with music. I've tried it, and it just, I don't know, there's something, it fills a space in my brain that I think I need. Although I know a lot of writers who do write with music, but I've just never been able to.
And you talked about the initial idea and then getting into the characters, so you don't outline. When you're writing, like, by the seat of your pants, as they say, how important is that in the discovery to you? And have you ever, to what extent, like, do you know the ending, or do you know the direction that you're headed when you start?
It varies. I mean, with the novel, I knew it was going to have a dark ending. I didn't necessarily know what it was. I actually didn't know what it was until I wrote it, but I kind of could see the arc. With my novella, Barracuda Backfire, I actually knew how that was going to end, and I wrote the ending before I'd even finished the middle of it. So sometimes I know, but other times I don't know till I, till I get to it. And, you know, my first story, A Hard Night in Hamburg, I had one ending and then I gave it to readers. And one of the readers, Derek Harr, whom we both know, thought the ending didn't work and suggested a change. And that really, it changed the whole arc of the story for better. So sometimes I don't know. I mean, I feel like sometimes I'll reach an ending and feel like I have it, but maybe it won't work. But my mind's never been good at outlining, but what has happened multiple times is if I get stuck and the plot's not working, I'll do a lot of brainstorming. I mean, I'll just start taking notes and then speculate, well, what if this happens? What if this happens? What if this person were this? What if this person were that? So basically trying out different ideas till I come upon one that works. And that in effect is like, if it's not an outline, it's close, and it's a way to work toward the ending. So that happens a lot.
Writing an ending before you've written the middle is all interesting to me. Do you write out of chronological order often, or is that a one-off?
No, I have before. Especially with that novel, I did more of it. With other novels too, especially if you end up shuffling parts around, I've done some of that out of chronological order before. Because if you know a scene has to be there and you're not sure how to get there, you can still write the scene. And then maybe in writing the scene, you'll see a way to get there.
So you mentioned your beta reader, and you actually change an ending based on that, which I've done too. And earlier you were talking about ShortCon and the connections to your first published story. To what extent is writing community important, and what would you recommend to people for getting involved?
All right, this is easy. It's everything. I mean, I wish I'd known this, when I first started. I mean, the advantage now is that you can do things remotely, and it's easier to find out where conferences are. But the first thing I would say is, like, join the Short Mystery Fiction Society, even if you don't write short stories. I mean, assuming you're a crime writer, because that's going to make you aware of a lot of conferences. It's also going to make you aware of a lot of calls for fiction. And you may find that, even if you're working on novels, excuse me, maybe a chapter from your novel would make a good short story, and there's a market for it. The next thing I would say is, if you're brand new to writing, Jane Friedman has a book called The Business of Writing, which is about as pragmatic as you can get. I think she outlines like 1 year of all the money she made, how much she was paid for everything she did. And you need to be, like, I think it's great to aim high, and people should aim for the bestseller list, or aim for, trying to write the best novel you can get. But also, be realistic that chances are if you're not at retirement age, you're going to have to do something else. And there's no harm in that. I mean, chances are it'll give you some good material, but be aware of how the business works. Join the Authors Guild. That's like $115 a year. They have a discount for students. That they do a lot of things for authors. They lobby for authors. They're part of a lawsuit, against an AI company. They'll kind of bring to light some of the things in the publishing world. If there's a Sisters in Crime chapter in your area, join that. That's very inexpensive to join. That'll put you, in a really broad community of writers, everything from cozy to hard crime. It's not just for women. I've been sort of late to the Writers Conference game because, I mean, I'm kind of daunted by big crowds, but there are smaller ones. Like ShortCon's a great example. It's one day. It's 40 people. It's not that expensive. If you're a member of Mystery Writers of America, it may be subsidized. But you'll meet a great group of people. You'll meet people in the industry. And, it's a way to – you may if you're not in a writer's group, you may meet people who want to be in a writer's group. I mean, I've always had the writing community. What I haven't had is like the professional side of it, where you learn where there's calls for submissions. You learn about the conferences. I mean, all that stuff's important. And you can pick and choose what to attend. But I think it's really important to be aware of what's out there, because you don't know what you don't know. And there was so much I didn't know, and I'm a lot more aware of things now.
So we're running short on time. If you had to pick one of those things that you didn't know to your younger self, what advice would, besides the writing community piece, what surprised you most during this publication process, and how would you advise an earlier version of yourself?
I would tell the earlier version, once you start pitching your novel, start on the next one, because you don't know how long the pitching's going to take. And if you wait till you're published, I mean, it could be years. So the one thing, do everything you can to get published, but don't stop writing. I mean, that's the big thing I would say, is don't wait months between projects. Just keep writing. Don't be afraid, especially if you haven't published, to try something different. You know, I wrote a bunch of first-person PI novels in retrospect. It would probably have been good for me to write a standalone, you know, third-person novel. And it also would have been good for me to, you know, write. I wasn't aware of the market for genre stories, but it's a much easier market to break into than the market for literary fiction. Especially now, there's lots of online publications for flash fiction. You know, get out there, try different things. Don't pigeonhole yourself. You know, once you're published, you know, your writing opportunities may narrow down, but right now, when you're unpublished, they're wide open. And take advantage of that.
And since you've just had your debut come out, is there anything that surprised you about actually being published, about that piece of it? Because it's obviously different than the writing.
I was pleasantly surprised by how easy it was to work with my publisher. And then I would say I kind of knew I had to do my own publicity and stuff, but I haven't fully dived into that, and that's something I need to do. And that's, you know, you're out there, your Facebook friends like your post, you know, you get some likes on Twitter or whatever, but then it kind of feels like you're in the void. So, you know, things like podcasts, things like, online interviews, you need to do that so people know where you are, know who you are. And, you know, you'll have the chance after your book's published to do that for somebody else, to help somebody else. You know, maybe you'll get asked to do a blurb for them. And the crime fiction community, especially, I can't emphasize this enough, it is incredibly generous. I mean, there are authors supporting other authors. I haven't really seen any pettiness or backbiting. I mean, you hear about fights in the literary community. You don't hear about it in crime fiction. I think it's just... We write really dark stuff, and we kill a lot of people, and there's a lot of revenge in our books. But you know, as people, we're not like that at all. So,
no, I couldn't agree more. And I think it extends beyond crime too. It's thriller and suspense and mystery, and like everybody in that world, it's all kind of related, right? Very supportive. Yeah. So my last question, Tom, is the simplest and also the hardest. Where do you think story comes from?
Well, I mean, I've thought about this. Like, if you look at those cave paintings in France, right, they're 50,000 years old. I don't know if they served a practical purpose or not, but I think there's an urge in humans to create. And I think storytelling is an extension of that. I mean, before there was written language, there was storytelling. Storytelling, you know, was used to pass on, like, historical, actually essential knowledge from one generation to the next. It is also a way to entertain and, I think, to inform. I mean, you know, you look at the parables in the Bible, like the prodigal son is actually kind of a complicated story. It's, like, emotionally rich or whatever. But if you just said the plot, you know, well, you should forgive people who've done bad things. I mean, there's no resonance there. You just feel like you're being lectured. But when you hear the story, it makes you think. It makes you wonder why. It makes you question. And, you know, Aesop's fables, right? They're teaching a lesson, but they're also entertaining. And I think people, they don't want to be lectured to, right? They want to be entertained, but they also want to be informed. And story, I think, makes us look at our own lives differently. I mean, writing them has made me look at my life differently, and then reading them, I think, has, you know, broadened my world. It's taken me places I'll never go, but made me think about things differently. So that, to me, is what it's all about.
Oh, that's a great answer. I love it. So where should viewers go to find your work?
Okay, you can go to my website, tommalani.com, and you can find it on bookshop.org, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Any of those places will have it. Just Google places that are gone and my last name. And it's easy to order, and it's out there. You can get it in paperback or ebook format.
Oh, that's great. Well, Tom, thanks. It's been a real pleasure. It was good having you here. And I always end by telling viewers to please, if they like your work, please rate it on Amazon, rate it on Barnes & Noble, wherever it is they're reading it. And please do the same for Elaine's Literary Salon. It helps people discover us.
Yeah,
so, Tom, thank you.
Well, I want to thank you so much for this. It was an honor to be here. And I've been to Elaine's a number of times. Besides having excellent food, the literary events they do, if you're writing a book and you want to do an event there, just let Jeff know. But I had my book launch there, and it was the experience was, you know, more than I could have asked for. It was just so wonderful. And everybody had a great time, and it was just, I couldn't think of a better place to launch my book. So thanks for that. And yeah, if you're in Old Town Alexandria, go to Elaine's. You won't be disappointed.
I appreciate the plug, and it was a pleasure to have you here and on the podcast, Tom. Good luck with your writing.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks.